It's called House Resources Committee meeting to order. Today we'll be continuing talking about House Bill 108 relating to aquatic farming. For the record, the members in attendance are co-chairmen Herman Cotton and Representative Schultz, Davidson, Sun, and Hoffman. Today what I'd like to do is continue listening to Fish and Game. Right now I'd like to have like 15 minutes for each department, Fish and Game, Natural Resources, and Environmental Conservation. And I know that probably isn't enough for you to review what they're going to say, but I think we can bring them back before this committee. And I'd like to have the Department of Commerce next week. And I'd also like to get into public testimony next week, because I think there's a lot of people online that are anxious to talk. And then about 9:30, I'd like to go into the marketing aspect. And we have Ron Rockinson Anchorage. At this time, I'd like to ask Brian Alley if he can come up and finish his testimony, and then we'll go into questions.
Good morning, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. I'd like to continue on here briefly as I can. I'd like to go back over a couple of issues. One, with regard to broodstock. Broodstock may be obtained from the spawning grounds prior to releasing their eggs or sperm, captured as adults in the fishery, or caught as they return to a freshwater hatchery. In all these three examples, the broodstock are part of an allocation process in managing the common property fishery and therefore subject to Board of Fisheries regulation. In the case of a mature freshwater hatchery operation, eggs from state or private nonprofit freshwater hatcheries could be sold if they were determined to be surplus in the sense of excess to the common property fishery. This determination of surplus represents de facto allocation, which is a Board of Fisheries decision. In terms of salmon ocean ranching and farming, they have in common this aspect of broodstock capture and or egg acquisition. They also have in common the concept of a freshwater hatchery and to some extent a saltwater pen rearing site. The saltwater pen rearing site is used to a limited extent in ocean ranching. A fish farm has been legally defined by the recent AG memo of March 10th as essentially a freshwater hatchery and a fresh or saltwater grow-out facility which raises the fish to market size under control or under captivity. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game feels that a fish farm and a PNP hatchery are functionally similar in terms of the biological concerns, and since all PNP hatcheries require permits by way of consistency, so should all fish farms. Based upon this assumption, the statewide disease and genetics policy should be applied to the fish farm permit in order to reduce the risk of damage to the wild stocks of salmon, which are a common property resource. Both policies have been well developed, and the implementation of these policies will serve as more than sufficient control. One large source of concern is the importation of exotic diseases with exotic species, such as Atlantic salmon. There are currently sufficient safeguards to prevent this from happening because it is illegal to import exotic finfish other than ornamental fish, aquarium fish, and only Pacific Northwest cultured Japanese oysters. The within-state transfer of fish or shellfish or eggs requires a fish transport permit. This permit involves finfish or shellfish disease certification and history, as well as a requirement to conform to the genetic policy. In addition, disease control is affected at a hatchery or rearing facility through disinfection procedures and yearly hatchery inspections. All disease outbreaks must be reported to the fish pathology section, which is required to recommend appropriate disposition of diseased fish or shellfish to the commissioner. Regarding the cost of management or the fiscal note, The estimate which was prepared with the bill by Fish and Game assumes minimal state involvement due to a pre-screening process of applicants. The cost of the fiscal note is a function of the type of salmon farming which develops in Alaska. The Norwegian model is a controlled development of farms which are limited in size by rearing volume. This can be contrasted with the British Columbian model, which is uncontrolled with no size limit and generally trends towards corporate farming. The social policy regarding the type of farming is clearly a legislative issue. However, the role of state involvement differs along this social policy continuum. Corporate farmers either export their technology needs from Norway or hire it. But the small entrepreneur may need some degree of help. Also, the ultimate number of farms, large or small, affects the cost of management. For instance, our fiscal note assumes 100 permit applications in fiscal year 88 and 20 operational fish farms by fiscal year 92 at a cost of $166,000 in fiscal 88 and $385,000 in fiscal 92. Since much of the discussion is focused on salmon farming, I think it would be appropriate to discuss the existing shellfish and proposed marine plant mariculture program in Alaska. Dr. Mike Kale here has been intimately involved in this program and can discuss this very briefly right at the moment to give you some background.
My name is Mike Kale. I'm the mariculture coordinator, Fred Division, Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I've been on the job since spring of 1986. My first assignment was to go to Japan as a guest of Japanese to study scallop mariculture as part of a cooperative agreement between the state of Alaska and OFCEA. I went with another fellow, a biologist from CANA, which is a Kodiak Area Native Association, and we stayed there for the summer and came back and are now preparing for a scallop spat collection feasibility study in Kodiak, which would investigate the biology of, or the feasibility of collecting young life stages of scallop to be processed for culture later on, and then the culture would be additional phases of the project that would be worked out either with or without the OFCEA. The fact that we traveled together, you know, me representing the state and a CANA representative, reflects our attitude on this whole program. Namely, that we've tried to have the state have a minimal involvement in these programs and to assist in technology development and then turn it over to private enterprise as quickly as possible. And in view of the tremendous potential of mariculture and of the relatively non-controversial nature of shellfish mariculture, we feel that perhaps, you know, this side is not appreciated as much as it might be in these hearings, so I wanted to kind of make that point that there is a side of this that's kind of received quiet notice, that's ongoing, and I think has a lot of promise and may end up with rewards for our state economy. So we've tried to move in a way that would promote a self-supporting industry, and in our project in Kodiak, which might serve as a model for this, we've set up the central project, which is involved with the Japanese scientists, and most of the funding that the state and the Japanese have provided are funneled into that. But we also have what we call cooperators. These are located at strategic points around the Kodiak Island system. These are private entrepreneurs that currently are working with us under a scientific educational permit, strictly for the purpose of collecting data and learning about this new technology. And as soon as this project is completed, we anticipate that they would step into the role of a businessman and the state would kind of back out and we would operate in a role that I perceive as minimal state involvement and encouraging self-supporting industries that can be put in place as quickly as possible. Bill Osborne, the CANA representative, and myself came back with a fair amount of knowledge about scallop mariculture. We're passing this along to our own staff, and this will be channeled through this project in Kodiak this summer. this program is essentially an add-on to a mariculture effort that's been going on in the state for some years. There are probably 3 or 4 oyster growers in the southeastern area that are selling product at this time. That is out of a number of maybe 6 or even 20 people that are either growing oysters in one form or another or contemplating growing oysters and are having difficulties of one sort or another. There's also at least one mussel operator that is selling products based in Cook Inlet. There's another one in Cordova that is capturing wild mussel, cleaning them by holding them in water to purge grit and what have you, and then selling them as a adult caught product. But he's contemplating getting into the farming business as well. There are, as I mentioned before, many interested people in the Kodiak area that are now working in cooperation with us that are hoping to become commercial operators as soon as we can find a way. So just to summarize, there's probably 15 to 20 in southeastern that either are growing shellfish or are getting ready to. And out of this, there are probably 2 or 3 that are selling product, and there are another 2 or 3 that are well-financed and could become, I think, major growers with a good chance of becoming independently financially sound, in other words, pay their own way. Most of the people that are existing now in the shellfish industry have to support their enterprise through other employment or second jobs. There's probably 5 to 10 in Prince William Sound in that same category, 5 to 10 in Cook Inlet, and probably 15 to 20 in Kodiak. Other activities around the state is a Macrocystis project, which is giant kelp, and this is another part of the State of Alaska OFCF cooperative program to develop a herring roe on kelp product for export to Japan. And this will take place in Sitka. A professor from the University of Alaska is the project leader, Dr. Mike Steckel. He will go to Japan, again, as a guest of the government, or as a guest of OFCF. He'll study there for 2 months, starting in August, and then return to commence the project next year, sometime in the late spring. Other shellfish programs that we're working on are little utilized species, but ones that I think have quite a bit of promise, such as the purple-hinged rock scallop. That's fairly common, but not in concentrated fashion anywhere throughout Alaska, and it has been evaluated for mariculture in places such as San Diego and British Columbia, and I'm working with fishermen and other people to explore this option as a way to get sea farming going. I don't know whether it's reasonable to talk about obstacles at this time, but just briefly I could touch on this. The reason that many of these people are as small as they are is there have traditionally been a lot of problems in getting their operations past that barrier where they can be economically self-supporting, and much of this is permit problems. Much of the memos that we have in our file from the AG's office were begin on the basis of trying to figure out how we could get people that are now in the shellfish industry on solid footing as far as permitting and licensing are concerned. We're still working on this and look at it as an important element. I look at it as an important element of my job. So the permitting issue is one that runs through the whole program, but I think it is important to realize that we do have some people right now in Alaska that have put time and effort and money into what they feel is a mariculture program that's already here. And we just need to put some statutes, hopefully, and regulations in place so they can proceed in what they would like to do in an orderly way. I'll stop there and answer questions.
I have a few questions here, a couple questions. You talked about like foreign technology, that you're looking at foreign technology or utilizing foreign technology. And then I'm wondering about like foreign investment, if there's foreign investment in there, and if you could maybe explain a little bit about the cooperative private entrepreneurs, if they're coastal residents, Alaska residents, or what. And then I have a follow-up question.
I hear a couple of questions there. I could start off with what I think is a question about why are the Japanese helping us? Is there foreign investment involved in this? Is that the question?
Well, kind of what I'm getting at is, you know, I want to see who's going to be running this operation. You know, I know that you're looking at foreign technology. I don't know where the foreign investment, what that places in the whole scenario. And, you know, I kind of want to know about who the private entrepreneurs that you're talking about are. You know, are they Kodiak Island residents? Are they Alaska residents?
I see. First of all, the foreign investment is not in this project. This is a gift from OFCF, and it's the way they phrase it is a goodwill effort to try to promote better trade relationships between Japan and Alaska. And so there's no strings attached, at least at the level of this project. This was negotiated through Commerce. I'm sure there are other discussions going on in other areas. But there is no expectation on the part that I can see of any payoff in terms of these projects to the Japanese. The people that are the entrepreneurs are local people in Kodiak. A retired fisherman is one of the prime candidates. Specifically, these cooperators have focused on villages. Akiak, Old Harbor, Port Lyons, and then other areas that are less developed, but what we feel have good possibilities for spat collection. Iswit Bay in front of our Katoi hatchery is another example of that. And we feel that the best thing that could happen to this is to go into these local hands, and so that's the whole point of our program. And that's what we've tried to do all along. The people in the Southeastern are also very local. There's a man that's developing a project in Prince of Wales Island that's lived in Alaska for 20 years. He has a local construction company. A fisherman in Metlakatla is one of the people that I'm trying to work with to get them started.
Okay, thank you. And then in the House research report, I'm sure you've seen it, the agriculture report, it talks about, and now this statement is kind of contradictory, you know, I can't figure it out, but maybe you can just comment on it. It says, compared to salmon, all other potential aquaculture products which could be developed in the near future within 5 years are likely to be of relatively minor economic importance. In the intermediate future, 5 to 10 years, the farming of oysters, mussels, scallops, and sea vegetables could substantially diversify the state's aquaculture industry and become important to the economies of coastal communities. So I guess the first question is about the salmon versus the sea vegetables and
shells. Well, I'm not an economist, but the way I read this is that the salmon offers fast money, relatively fast money, and it's proved out as being so. The shellfish is not as high a priced a product, and there's more of a lag time to come up to speed. We feel that, for example, a scallop farmer, once we get the technology worked out, would require probably 5 years before he started getting a product that could be marketed. And there are some questions about economic feasibility of any of this, but our attitude is that we're going to treat these people as though they're private businessmen, which they are, and they risk their own capital and test their own markets and get into it in that way. So I really am not qualified to answer questions on economics, but that's my surface reading of it.
Okay. We're on to the conference, is that correct?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question for both of you. And first, I'd like to ask Dr. Kale. You indicated that the shellfish effort is relatively non-controversial. And I was wondering if you could please expand on that non-controversiality and explain why it is much less controversial than the pinnerid salmon issue.
Sure, I can. I think that the main issue, and at least in my mind, and this is a personal opinion, and the salmon problem is marketing. And I don't see a conflict with a shellfish product as far as markets are concerned. We've dealt with the draggers in Kodiak that fish for scallop, and they come to our workshops and bring product in and actually try to help us find locations to collect broodstock. And one of the, way down the road, one of the ways that this mariculture program could work is by seeding areas of ocean bottom, and the draggers would be allowed to actually participate. And the Japanese have done this, and that's one of their most successful projects, is the seeding of ocean bottom and then the fishing with trawling. Yeah. So the fishermen have no problem with this.
The, if I may, Manager, the amount of space required for shellfish operation, is that a lot of the area that is tied up in the tidal areas, or is it relatively confined?
That's a real good question, and that relates back to what Dr. Lee said a minute ago. We need to work carefully through some sort of process to evaluate proper siting. And I talked to some of the people in Kodiak, that one of the writers of the 12 fishermen letter to Senator Zaroff. I asked him about shellfish mariculture, what his problems were, and he said that the only thing that he could really think of that would bother him would be tying up anchorages, fishing grounds, and so forth. And I would suggest working closely, directly with people like that through programs such as Coastal Zone or other mechanisms to make sure that the fishermen's needs are looked after. I think there's room for both in all these programs, but I think it has to be done thoughtfully and carefully, and we have to avoid the BC situation.
Thank you. If I may...
Yeah, could you kind of wind down the process that we can always bring
back? I just wanted to indicate, well, do you know if there's a, you mentioned commerce in the goodwill effort by Japan, the Department of Commerce. Is there, is that in any way tied to the allocation issue of groundfish or other species, do you know?
I'd be really hesitant to answer that. I'm sorry, I don't like to duck questions. But
yeah. Okay, thanks. Dr. Ali, I had a quick question for you. You indicated that all disease outbreaks must be reported, and that the state would provide the personnel to inspect these farms once a year. And I was just wondering, what do you envision as the, in event there are pin-reared salmon operations around, how would we ensure that disease outbreaks, in fact, would be noticed as quickly as possible? Would those separate operations have their own technicians that would constantly, on a daily or a weekly basis, check out things for disease?
Yes, Madam Chairman. Yes, I think what you'd find is that the people that are running those farms would be concerned with the health and welfare of their own fish. So they would be tracking them, and they would be looking at help in professional health and diagnostic services. That seems to be at least the approach that's been done in other states, and specifically in British Columbia, there's a critical lack of professional pathologists there who can help with disease diagnosis and certification. And so that when you look at this fiscal note issue, you have to understand that it was developed on the basis of 20 operating farms. If the farm number of farms exceeds that, of course, then the costs would go up. And it may well be another scenario could be kicked in whereby pathologists who are currently certified through the American Fisheries Society Fish Health Section could be used in the state of Alaska as a sort of a private laboratory, and then this infrastructure starts to grow and develop. That's a possibility as well.
So we can assume then, as well as in British Columbia, in Alaska as well, there is a critical shortage of pathologists for that kind of job?
I think you'll find that that would be the case if you have a very large program.
Thank you. Thank you, Matthew.
For the record, I'd like to note the presence of Representative Navar and Pearson. We have also Representative Menard visiting, Representative Simon and Representative Cotton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to get to the concept of the fiscal note, Brian, a little bit, and it seems to me that you kind of hit on a major point here. If we make a policy determination of what kind of industry do we want this to be? Do we want it to be a large corporate farm industry or a small ma-and-pa type industry? And a lot of the sympathy, I think, in past discussions has been towards the smaller farms. And your statement says, well, the smaller the farm gets, the larger the state's responsibility for technical resources and technical assistance is going to be. Is that a correct evaluation?
Yes, Madam Chairman. I would say that that to a certain extent is a personal opinion in the way I would look at the situation. I can't quite imagine how the small farmers are going to have the R&D capability to do a lot of this work themselves. So they're going to turn to an agency. One could envision turning to the university system through the Sea Grant program, analogous to the Department of Agriculture and the land grant colleges sort of thing. But they will no doubt be knocking on the door at Fish and Game. A number of people are already talking to Dr. Kale here about mariculture. So I think the costs will rise as a function of the social policy.
Just and I tend to agree with you, and I always want to, in your fiscal note that you've laid out, one of your substantive or your backup comments is that you depended upon the Division of Marine Resource Division of BC Provincial Government and called them and looked at their activity, and it states that you need two full-time technicians and thereafter manpower needs would diminish. I guess I would appreciate some range of fiscal impact notes if we adopted a large corporate style where the corporations provided a large amount of R&D, what would you see Fish and Game's involvement to the other range of just a lot of small ma and pa, and so that we could get some sideboards put up here on what we're looking upon as maybe a potential state impact. And I just want a little editorial comment. I'll say that in the aquaculture program, you know, we committed about $40 million of state bond money, I think, in 72, and we put about $40 million of state loans into the PNPs. But when it came time for the state to deliver on operating those hatcheries and putting the operating costs behind the capital costs, the state blinked. And the state is cutting the budgets, and we're closing the hatcheries, and we're shutting it down, and Fish and Game's budget is getting trashed right now. And I think if we're going to get into depending upon the state to deliver fish and game resources to give technical assistance to this industry, the past example of the ability of the legislature to deliver is negative. And I think we ought to be real careful about depending upon those dollars in the future. If an example of what we're doing to the fish and game budget and university budgets is anything to go by. Another issue is the pre-screening. You mentioned a comment that you were going to do some pre-screening of applicants to kind of cut down on the technical assistance you'd have to deliver, and I just wonder if you had an idea how you were going to do that.
Well, these discussions actually in terms of pre-screening went on before I came on board, as a matter of fact, but I believe that's kind of the concept that is in the present bill, and that is the concept that the multi-agency group that kind of looked at this issue and the fisheries cabinet that looked at this thought in terms of some sort of screening process with some criteria and applied to see that if people could really prove up on this their capability to do a creditable job of developing a fish farm and or a shellfish activity, and kind of a series of roadmaps, milestones, so that you avoid speculation and don't tie up these sites needlessly.
Okay, I'd appreciate just later on, Madam Chairman, I'm going to pursue that issue. I think we had a real great difficulty that of the state trying to do that when our ag projects, and I'd quite like to see how we're going to do it here and make it work legally. But thank you.
Representative
Cotton. Madam Chairman, first I'd like to say that I know that the farm sponsors sitting in the audience, and it might be more appropriate for you to sit at the table with us if you can find a place, in case you have questions for the agency people too. Yeah, your pleasure, of course. But
thank you.
I have a quick question, Madam Chairman, on the oyster spat, I guess you call it, that is used to begin growth for new oysters. How is that? Is there a permit required now to move that? How is that different than what someone might need for, say, a permit to move salmon eggs?
Madam Chairman, the oyster industry is grandfathered in, basically, and it's been around for about 10 years or even more, and it's a little different from anything else that's going on in the state in that all the seed comes from outside hatcheries. And the certification of this stock, the seed stock, if you will, involves carefully screening the hatchery that provides the spat for disease and other issues, and then permitting the individual oyster farmer as well. So that's really a unique example.
Would it be the same authority that would allow you to issue a permit there as it might be for the salmon eggs?
I don't think the two issues are very closely related because there is virtually no allocation issues at all involved in the oyster spat problem. The people buy the spat from hatcheries, and at that point they own that material, and the only thing that the Fish and Game is concerned about is protection of existing natural populations. Whereas with the salmon eggs, we have problems with the existing PNP structure and how that relates to private for-profit. We have allocation problems of returning fish and what the destination of those fish are and what the disposition of them might be, the trade-offs between different user groups and so forth. So the salmon eggs, it becomes quite complicated.
I'll pursue that later.
Okay. Thank you. I'd like to wind down now. We'll take questions at a later time. Thank you. At this time, I'd like to call DNR. Thank you.
Representing the Department of Natural Resources. I would like to briefly describe the permitting process that prospective aquatic farmers now face, and then briefly describe DNR's role within that process. This one chart that you have shows what happens now to an applicant when he comes in the door. Right now, an applicant for an aquatic farm may have to get as many as 8 to 10 or 12 permits. The application is filled out, a coastal project questionnaire is filled out and turned into OMB's Department of Governmental Coordination, and from there is distributed to all resource agencies. This is the process for resource agencies. Some departments aren't included in this. The agencies review the projects and they make recommendations back to OMB. OMB issues a consistency determination, consistency with the Alaska Coastal Management Program. And at that point, the agencies adjudicate the permits, issue or deny permits, and they go back to the applicant. Most tidelands in Alaska are owned by the state, and for use of the tidelands, an applicant will apply to DNR. The department wants to ensure that tidelands are used in a fair and orderly manner. With the possible influx of many new applications that might result from this bill, we have several concerns. We can expect an increase in competing uses. The best place for an aquatic farm will often be the best anchorage. It will be the best place for a timber transfer facility, for recreation, for subsistence activities. So with this large number of new applications, how do we decide who gets to use which area? We have currently some guidance in the Alaska Coastal Management Program and in coastal district plans where they exist. And in 88, we will have a DNR tidelands plan for Prince of Wales Island. But the legislature may want to provide some guidance, some specific criteria for making competing use decisions. Another concern we have, aside from competing uses, is the cumulative impacts of these projects on the tidelands. We've all heard of the British Columbia example. We want to make sure that we don't follow it, that we don't duplicate that example. The third concern is speculation. Tidelands ought to be available to project developers, but not to middlemen who want to hold or reoffer to the highest bidder those tidelands. The two primary vehicles that DNR has for allowing use on the tidelands is a lease and a permit. And I've handed out a fact sheet which will describe in a little more detail what each of those do. Briefly, the leases, existing lease and permit structure currently have some shortcomings. For the aquatic farmer, a permit is issued for a period of 1 year. It doesn't offer much tenure in the land. It can be revoked without cause in 30 days. The fee is currently $150 a year, an acre. $50 of that is an application fee. And $150 an acre a year isn't much to pay for use of a prime acre of tidelands. A lease, you compete for a lease at an auction. That may not be ideal for someone who's done a lot of research on one site and wants to obtain that site. He has to. He could have done the research. Someone at the auction can outbid him. A survey and appraisal is required, which makes a lease expensive to obtain up front. It may be preferable to consider basing fees on gross receipts rather than on a percentage of fair market value. We all, I think, agree that a reasonable return for use of the tidelands is important. We understand that some amendments are being drafted which would address some of our concerns, and we look forward to reviewing that information. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Paula. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Paula, you bring, again, a lot of big questions, and the biggest one, of course, is how, and I would just like to ask, how do you envision getting a handle on this matter of speculation at DNR?
Well, we'd like to see some language in the bill which would give us a hand with that. I have a few ideas. I think it would be important to have very specific prove-up mechanisms, development schedule required. There's been talk of a fit, willing, and able screening. There are pros and cons to that. Right now, Commerce is written into the bill as having a lead role. It would be possible to have Commerce do the fit, willing, and able screening up front, which would mean that some applications would be weeded out and not. Resource agencies, all agencies aren't going to have to review every single application that comes in. That's a costly process. The third thing, one thing in itself that reduces speculation is having a requirement that a complete package be presented. That weeds out a lot of people. People don't like the paperwork. And also, I guess, a cleanup bond would be a part of that.
So you describe a process that is lengthy, takes staying power, as well as being acutely informed as to what the process is, then. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
Representative
Sun. Yeah, I was just going to comment that we just had a discussion on the fit, willing, and able test for pipeline right-of-ways. It might be worthwhile to look and see whether. I see the pipeline right-of-way company are trying to get away from trying to show fit, willing, and able up front, but. We can take a look at that. Just a specific question, Paul, on the, you've completed a tidelands planning process for, I think it's the outside of Prince of Wales Island. How does that, in that process, the use of the land for aquatic farming fit in? Was that discussed in that planning process? Are there sites made available for that?
The way it's being handled, the plan that's being prepared covers the entire island. It is primarily a tidelands plan because the state doesn't own many uplands on Prince of Wales Island. The folks who are preparing the plan have prepared a rather lengthy section entitled Guidelines for Mariculture Activities. And this has been, I think it's going to the planning team to be discussed. It proposes, and they've discussed doing it a number of ways, they've discussed excluding applications from certain areas, they've discussed providing areas for the activity to occur. The way it is heading right now is that areas would be designated for certain activities to occur primarily, and say it's a high habitat area, you would not be as likely to obtain a mariculture facility within that area. So right now they're talking classifications which would discourage in some areas, encourage in others.
Well, Madam Chair, if I just followed up, in terms, what's the decision-making process to determine between the land use conflicts? You know, I think out there is a good example of the giant kelp. Macrocystic kelp is now harvested out there in abundance and hauled off to Prince William Sound for herring to spawn on. So we know the stuff grows there, but how would you make a determination if somebody wanted to go in and put that site in, say, in Cordova Bay, which I think the plan's been completed for the outside coast anyway, or the southeast portion?
Right, southwest portion of Prince of Wales Island.
Yeah. What process would you go through to make the decision of who gets the site?
You would look at the classification that existed for that area, and you would look at the specific criteria within the plan. The plan, as proposed, the new plan, has very specific criteria for mariculture, which are still being formulated. The old plan, the Southwest Prince of Wales Island, doesn't have that specific information on mariculture. It wasn't, at the time, an issue, and so it wasn't put into the plan. It will be in the new plan. So you look at that specific criteria, and you'd make a decision based on that. After that, the specific project reviewer makes a state's best interest determination.
Okay, and that's all the they and the thems, they're all in DNR?
Yes. That's for the Thailand lease or permit, yes.
Okay.
Paul, can you tell me how many people you have working in the Thailand lease program now?
Oh, gosh. In my office, we have three. I'm regional manager for the Southeast region, and I would have to check back and see how many the other two regions have. There are three regions.
Timing and applications, taking them on a one-by-one and making a state's best interest finding, and, you know, rejecting or accepting a permit for us or an application for a site. Do you have any other ideas about a way to take a more comprehensive view and to mitigate resource conflicts?
Madam Chairman, we're concerned about the cumulative impacts of this new thing on the tidelands, and one idea that I had was you could accept applications year-round and hold those applications, adjudicate them beginning at a set time each year so that you could notify the public, everyone was aware that this process was underway, there would be public hearings, and then within, say, a two-month period, you would review all of the applications for that year rather than on a piecemeal basis throughout the year.
That's an idea that I find pretty attractive in terms of the public hearing process and public notice in general, and just a way to take a comprehensive view of things and try and reduce potential resource conflicts. You've also discussed with us your idea for percentage of gross receipts to recover costs. Can you expand on that a little more?
I wish that I had more information on it. We've gotten a copy of California's regulations. They charge a percentage of gross receipts for their mariculture program. The Forest Service here in town also uses gross receipts. The more sophisticated land management agencies do that. I think it offers the applicant an advantage. It doesn't stifle an infant industry because it doesn't charge a lot up front, but as the farm begins to produce, then the state gains from that. in the end, I think the state stands to gain considerably more using gross receipts, a percentage of gross receipts, than it would charging a flat rate based on fair market value.
Thank you.
If I could follow up on that, we could use some of our oil leasing criteria. If you have more than one person who wants the site, see who bids the highest gross receipts number to the state and put it out that way.
Paul, I'm sure we have a lot more questions for you, and we'll be bringing you back before the committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
At this time, I'd like to ask DEC if they could come up and testify.
Good morning. I'm Doug Gonigan from the Department of Environmental Conservation. I'm the Director of Environmental Health. HB 108 does not identify that the Department of Environmental Conservation assume any new duties or functions. There are, however, two areas of current agency responsibility which would be impacted to some extent by an increase in aquatic farming. These existing responsibilities are the certification of shellfish growing areas and the regulation of discharges from any type of aquatic farming. Shellfish, such as oysters and mussels, can only be grown or harvested in areas certified by the department. The certification process is done according to guidelines created by the National Shellfish Sanitation Program and the Federal Food and Drug Administration. Certification of the growing area is necessary for any product to be sold in interstate commerce. A growing area certification requires that the proposed area be surveyed for potential sources of chemical and biological pollution. The water quality is evaluated through a series of samples, and levels of paralytic shellfish poison are determined in several species within the area. After certification, the area is periodically reevaluated, and shipments of shellfish are routinely sampled for PSP. The department also regulates the discharges of aquaculture operations through state certification of Corps of Engineer and EPA permits. The department has submitted a zero fiscal note based upon the fact that the bill does not define any additional agency responsibilities. However, after hearing more about the bill and the possible number of facilities that might be engaged in this type of activity, the department is reconsidering that fiscal note. It may be that aquaculture activity resulting from the bill might be great enough to exceed the department's current ability to regulate. Technically, we have some concerns that 8610B, which authorizes the holder of a Department of Commerce permit to transfer and sell aquatic farm products, may supersede or conflict with DEC's current shellfish certification and permitting system. We recommend the language be clarified to ensure that no legal complications occur from this. The department is also investigating whether standards for areas used for aquatic farming, such as salmon farming, similar to those for shellfish area certification, should be developed. Any questions?
Mr. Davidson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Donegan, I understand that the PSP program is a very costly program, and presently the only facility in the state we have to do that is in Palmer. And further, I understand that by working through the Fisheries Industry Technology Center in Kodiak, that there is a possibility of some kind of new process, and I was just wondering if, in fact, your department has been in touch with the people in Kodiak, Dr. Yong Lee, and if you know anything or can expand on that at all.
In terms of new technology or approved methods for testing for PSP, the Federal Food and Drug Administration has to certify any new methodology. Currently, there are, I believe, a couple of different types, including high-pressure liquid chromatography, that are being investigated. When those methods are approved by FDA, then, of course, we will probably adopt them.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of questions on the certification of growing areas. Are there any certified beaches or tidelands areas in southeast Alaska at this time?
Yes, there's, I believe, four certified growing areas in southeast.
Are they allowed to sell their product directly into the market off of those certified growing areas?
Yes, after it's tested. routinely test each samples from each lot that enters into commerce.
Yeah, and the way it works, Doug, isn't it that every harvest sample has to be retained in a batch, and that a sample that has to go to Palmer to be tested, and when it clears, then you can sell that batch?
Yes, that is correct.
So the beaches, in terms of being certified, really aren't certified directly into the market. Every item coming off there has to go through a testing process.
That is correct.
I think in terms of other areas, I think in Washington or other areas that don't have a high PSP problem, that you can actually get a beach or a tidelands area certified and everything off that can go directly into the market.
Yes, and that basically is in areas that have a long established history and a database has been established there for PSP levels. We don't have many areas like that in Alaska since this is a relatively new process.
Yeah, we've spent a lot of money trying to figure out how to field certify beaches for PSP. I've been involved with that for quite a while. We've never figured it out how to do it. My other set of questions are two questions. One, in terms of discharge into the common, into the water, I'm just wondering, I assume that all these farms are going to have to get national pollution discharge permits in terms of the fish species or whatever you want to go in the water. All of our existing hatcheries have to have them. Is DEC involved in that process?
Yes, we certify those permits, although it may well be that they need Corps of Engineers permits, since it, I'm not sure about this, but they may not be considered a point source discharge. Point source is NPDES, and non-point source would be 401 permits.
Okay, but they're going to be one or the other.
Right, and they would be certified by
us. And that goes through your shop, too?
That goes through the Division of Environmental Quality.
Okay. The... I bring the example up because I think it was Commissioner Collinsworth testifying here that made some statement as to the volume of discharge from a 1 or 2 acre fish farm over a year being the equivalent of the discharge from a town of 40 or 50,000 people. So to me it seems a substantial number, and I just wondered how DEC is going to involve itself in the permitting process to look at the water quality standards at each one of these sites with a zero fiscal note. Mm-hmm.
Well, that I have stated that we are reassessing that fiscal note. We did not anticipate that there were going to be 100 salmon farming sites when we drafted that note. And we do have the ability to issue general permits, which substantially cut down on the amount of paperwork associated with the issuance of those permits.
Do you look for putting a testing lab in Southeast Alaska so that we don't have to send all our stuff to Palmer every day?
At the current time, we don't. It used to be an issue that we heard about quite frequently, the lack of a Southeast PSP testing lab. There were some logistical problems involved in the shipment of samples to Palmer. We believe that we've overcome those, and we have not had any complaints from growers in at least the last year since we instituted some changes. We do have 24-hour turnaround time in Palmer, and most growers utilize express mail shipment, so they get the results very quickly now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, I think I'm going to wind it down here. I want to get to the marketing aspect. Thank you very much, and we'll probably be talking to you again.
Thank you.
At this time, Ron Rockness in Anchorage, if you could come forward and talk about your study, the marketing relationship between Pacific and Penray salmon, a survey of U.S. seafoods. I'm sure that fishermen are anxious to hear you, and so are we. Can you proceed?
Yes, Madam Chairman. It's my understanding that the members have the document in hand. Is that correct?
That's correct, and we have 20 minutes, so if you could sum things up in 10 minutes, and then we can ask questions, okay?
As noted in the document, this survey is part of a larger report. The other main part of that study is an econometric analysis focusing on the European market, where both products have existed for the longest period of time. It does not appear that the result, which estimates the relationship between changes in the quantity of Penray's Atlantic and in the price of Pacific wild Pacific salmon, will be of use to policymakers, as some severe weaknesses in the data make meaningful results extremely difficult. The results of this survey are dependent upon the assumption that wholesalers' behavior in substituting Pacific and pen-raised Atlantic is directly linked to the consumer's behavior. We assume that those distributors have knowledge of consumers' preferences and respond accordingly. The report shows the following results. Number one, not surprisingly, the Norwegian dominant product in the market. There were, however, a surprisingly large number of firms purchasing product from U.S. salmon farms. This must have been from the East Coast, since at that time, West Coast salmon farms were not selling product as yet. Those firms, or number two, those firms handling pen-raised salmon are mostly smaller firms, that is, sales less than 10 million, which have also experienced rapid growth rates from 82 to 85. Point three, a large majority of firms believe that fresh Atlantics compete only with fresh Pacific salmon and not frozen. Conversely, few believe that fresh Atlantics compete with frozen Pacific salmon. However, the white tablecloth restaurant market is an important market for both the producers of fresh Atlantics and troll caught Chinooks and Coho. Therefore, the number of respondents to 15 or 26% who felt the frozen wild Pacific salmon compete with fresh pen-raised Atlantic should not be dismissed. Four, the majority of firms do not believe frozen Atlantics compete with either fresh Pacific or frozen Pacific. The results may be because of the relatively small amount of imported frozen Atlantics coming into this country. We should note, however, that if the fresh market becomes glutted, more Atlantics may be necessarily frozen, and this relationship could become more important. Five, the number of firms initiating distribution of pen-raised Atlantics peaked in 1982 and fell off considerably afterward. This may seem in contradiction to expectations because of steadily increasing sales. However, these firms have expanded rapidly in terms of sales, which would explain the discrepancy. Six, the number of firms distributing Atlantics due to requests from customers and those distributing due to requests by suppliers is fairly evenly split. Although not conclusive, the results show that in earlier years, a larger number of businesses entered the industry due to pressure from suppliers. And then, as consumer acceptance of the product grew, the consumer requests brought a larger share of entrants into the market. Point seven, a sizable number of respondents, or 37%, feel their purchases of Pacific and Atlantics are fully independent of one another, while 26% purchase salmon only when Pacifics are not available. Because of results from question four, some of them must feel that the two products are somewhat competitive. However, it may be possible that these products are complementary by an overall increase in consumer awareness and exposure to fresh salmon. Also should note, five respondents felt that the products competed directly with one another in almost all markets. Point eight, the seasonal composition of Atlantic salmon imports conforms with our expectations, with the majority of salmon marketed in times of the year when the fresh Pacific salmon is not available. As for future plans, the majority of firms plan to increase their sales while maintaining current seasonal distribution or emphasize increased distribution in the winter months. If the current distribution is maintained, we should note that those times of year when fresh Pacific salmon is available will be witnessing ever-increasing amounts of pen-raised Atlantic. There's a chart on page two of your report, and we can see this trend. It's a shift upward in the amount of imports coming into this country. Note that in August of 1985, the imports from Norway were greater than any month in 1983. Although summer imports are substantially less than the winter months of that particular year, one should look at the absolute level to gain a better understanding. The final questions identified the advantages of Atlantics and Pacifics over one another. Some of these advantages can be addressed by Pacific salmon fishermen and marketers, while some may be much more difficult. The primary advantage of Atlantics over Pacifics were year-round availability, freshness, consistency, and size. While Pacific salmon fishermen and processors can respond by instituting stricter quality standards, something that's already been undertaken by ASME, and a more consistent sorting by size. The most listed advantage of wild Pacific salmon over Atlantics were flesh characteristics and price. The flesh characteristics included were color, firmness, and a lower fat content. These advantages could be utilized by those selling wild Pacific salmon and marketing their products. The most mentioned advantage, price, is significant in that overall world supply of pen-raised salmon continues to increase. A price decrease would be expected. Thus, this price advantage of Pacific over Atlantics could be Whether salmon farming could be profitable at a lower price depends on technological advances or supply bottlenecks being alleviated, which could reduce their overall cost. The second survey, which was sent to firms which did not handle or distribute pen-raised salmon, results of that study are not as conclusive as the first. It does indicate that there's a fairly large number of wholesalers or distributors who could enter this industry at some time in the future. That concludes my summary. I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Okay, Ron, I have one question. I know you were talking about some of the problems and concerns you had with doing the econometric study, and that you probably weren't going to get into that. Can you tell me what kind of follow-up to this this study that you'll be doing, if any?
Well, that report will be presented to my committee. The results as far as interpretation and application, as far as the developing that price relationship, will be a public, of course, but I would, the weaknesses are going to be very evident in there. There are several efforts underway currently to look at some different data. I was using the European market data, and that didn't work that well. There's a gentleman in Fairbanks who I believe will have a report ready on the domestic market, on the U.S. market, early this next month. And there's also a firm out of British Columbia, which is a private research firm, which is doing much the same thing for the Canadian market and the U.S. market both.
Thank you. Are there questions,
Committee? Yeah, just a basic question. Do you see the displacement in the U.S. or world markets of wild stocks with pen-reared salmon?
The displacement, you're talking about market displacement?
Yes.
My personal opinion, based on the reading that I've done and the work that I've collected, is that there may, in fact, be a displacement in certain markets, given current structure of the salmon farming industry. However, there appears that a large segment of the industry, that of frozen salmon, perhaps like plain caught salmon, and some of the other, like pink, chum, and sockeyes, may not be displaced given the current structure. However, if the structure changes, some of the displacement may occur in those species as well. But that's not in the foreseeable future.
Just for the committee's benefit, Madam Chairman, the fellow's name at the University of Alaska Fairbanks is Robert Logan, and he is looking more specifically at the impacts on Alaska market share of pen-reared salmon, so I think that'd be real valuable information for the committee. And we have heard a lot from Mr. Rognes and others about the effects of pen-reared cohos. I'm interested, as I know proponents and opponents involved in this debate are, the effects of pen-reared Chinooks on the market. So I hope to concentrate on that and just remind everyone that we're talking about, at the moment, very generalized data about worldwide impacts. And I'm really interested in the effects on Alaska's fishermen and of entry into the market of these new products. So just a comment.
Fishermen are anxious to know. Are there further questions? If not, I'd like to thank you very much for your testimony, and we'll probably be talking with you again, Ron.
Madam Chairman.
Do the committee have any other comments about who they'd like to come before a committee and things like that? If not, I think what I'll do is mention to the people online that the information that we're using, the House Research Aquaculture Report and this report and other information, if people want to call into my office, they can do that and try to obtain some of this information.
No, I just want to comment afterwards, Madam Chairman, of other people that should be involved in this. I think in particularly Southeast Alaska, we should speak with the U.S. Forest Service in the fact that they control almost all of the uplands, anything above the 14-foot mean high water mark in Southeast. And it seems that whenever you have a boat or a floating thing in the water, you need a shack on the shore someplace, and what their policies are going to be regards to this type of development. And another comment I'd like to make, I know we're going to come back to public testimony next week, but I'd just like the committee to be aware that a substantial number of people who have, this is a dire concern to the fishermen, are not available next week. We have the Cushakes herring fishery going off south to Ketchikan, the Sitka herring roe fishery. We have a black cod season that's just opening up now, and the trolling season closes April 15th, so we have a lot of people out fishing trying to get their last fishing trip in. So although we will have some public testimony next week, I'd just like people to be aware that many, many of the people who are really concerned with this are not going to be available unless we open up the marine operator radio and let them talk on the radio system to us. So, thank you. That is the most public way to get this knowledge out.
We'll definitely take that into concern. Nothing further to come before House Resources Committee.